This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Well, in this hour, we're going to talk about a new report coming out from the United Nations, which talks about the last decade, the decade of 2000 to 2010, which was, in some sense, a crazy decade. You know, Bob Dylan made famous the words, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing." And everybody on the planet Earth has some horror story about the weather gone berserk. We have this wacky weather everywhere you go on the planet Earth. You see the fact that it's not a typical year or typical decade. We're seeing a new normal. We're seeing 100-year storms, 100-year hurricanes, 100-year droughts, 100-year forest fires. Recently, for example, I was touring through Europe where the media was dominated by the fact there was massive flooding in Eastern Europe and also in Germany. And they had to go back 500 years to find anything comparable. And of course, the records petered out during the Middle Ages. You can't go much farther back than that. Some people are saying that was perhaps the worst flooding in 1,000 years. We really don't know. We just know that it was off scale. So everybody has a horror story. For example, in the Southwest, we have gigantic forest fires, fatal forest fires that kill firemen and also create droughts, which could raise the price of crops. In the Mississippi, we have flooding. And then in the Northeast, we were battered by Hurricane Sandy. What is it all about? Well, the United Nations has a new report that just came out. It's from the UN's World Meteorological Organization. And it says that they are experiencing unprecedented extremes in terms of measurements since 2001. So in other words, the last decade, as everybody knows anecdotally, was perhaps one of the wackiest decades with the most violent swings that we have measured since around 1850. So let me just quickly lay out what the United Nations found. First of all, tremendous heat waves that gripped Europe, killing thousands of people. The heat wave in Europe in 2003, for example, killed 66,000 people. There was a similar heat wave in Russia in 2010, which killed 55,000 people. And in fact, these extreme events, say the United Nations, led to a total of 370,000 people dying as a consequence, up 20% from the decade of the 1990s. So on one hand, we have heat waves. But on the other hand, we have massive flooding, and that seems to contradict common sense. Why do we have these violent swings in the weather? First of all, global warming is actually a misnomer. We should change it to global swings. In other words, you can have droughts in one area, for example, in the American Southwest. Simultaneously, you can have flooding in the Mississippi. Simultaneous to that, you can have gigantic hurricanes battering Texas and battering the American Northeast. So in other words, when you heat up something, it doesn't uniformly heat up. You get swings as a consequence. And that's what we're seeing all over the planet Earth. And these swings, we think, are new. The last decade went down as perhaps one of the hottest decades ever recorded in the history of science. If you take a look at the decade of 2001 to 2010, every year of that decade, except for the year 2008, was among the 10 warmest ever recorded since the 1850s. In fact, 2010 went down as the hottest year that has ever been recorded by scientists since 1850. And so we know anecdotally that 2010, that decade, came out as the hottest decade ever recorded in science. And then we have massive storms. We had, of course, Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And everybody in the Northeast knows about Hurricane Sandy, which cost tens of billions of dollars in damages. But around the world, we see something similar. Cyclone Nargis in Burma in 2008. In Pakistan, we had devastating floods in 2010. In the Amazon basin, we had droughts. And Australia, East Africa, we also saw droughts. And not only that, we also have signs of retreating of every single major glacier on the planet Earth. If you take a look at satellite photographs taken at the dawn of the space age and compare them with satellite photographs taken today, we see the unmistakable imprint of global warming. Every single major glacier is receding on the planet Earth. In fact, when schoolchildren read about the snows of Kilimanjaro, a novel written by Hemingway, they'll have to ask the question, well, everybody knows that Kilimanjaro has no snows. And also, it's going to affect Christmas. Children are going to say, well, we all know that Santa Claus is a fake because Santa Claus lives in the North Pole, and there is no North Pole. In fact, in summertime, we see the fact that the ice completely melts at the North Pole, and we expect sometime in mid-century that's going to be permanent. That is, we'll see a permanent hole at the top of the planet Earth. Now, to be fair, some people say, bah, humbug. This is all liberal propaganda. It's nothing but bleeding hearts that want to soak the taxpayers to chase after some cockamamie scheme to phase out big oil and bring in a solar era. In other words, some people say there's a hidden agenda. And that computer programs, well, yeah, computer programs are nice, but they're not definitive. In fact, some computer programs can give you nonsense. And so some people say that let's take a look at the record, and the record says that there is no global warming. Well, let's take it apart one by one. First of all, some of the skeptics of global warming point to the fact that the Earth has been heating up for 10,000 years. And that's absolutely right. 10,000 years ago, we had the end of the last glaciation. Parts of North America were under perhaps half a mile of ice. And we've been experiencing a melting of that ice. That's why we have the Great Lakes. That's why we have many of the lakes in the United States as remnants of the ancient glaciers that used to be here. And some people are saying that, well, yeah, if the Earth is heating up, it's a natural cycle. These ice ages come and go. 10,000 years from now, we'll be under another half a mile of ice, and so we'll have global cooling as a consequence. Well, let's take a look at the record. Yes, it's true that the Earth has been heating up for the last 10,000 years. We are in an interglacial period right now. Another 10,000 years will be under ice. However, there's a spiking, an unusual spike in the temperature that is not part of the gradual warming of the Earth in the last 10,000 years. That's the reason why scientists say that, yes, the Earth has been heating up for 10,000 years, but now it's unnatural. Since the beginning of the Industrial Age, we see the fact that in the last 100 years or so, temperatures have risen about 1 degree, about 1 degree. And if you take a look at sea level rise has been about 1 foot in the last 100 years. In fact, if you go to some places along the Northeast and you can actually see where the waterline used to be in low tide, you can see very clearly that sea levels have risen about 1 foot in the last 100 years. Some of the critics also point to satellite data. There was one satellite which showed that the Earth was actually cooling down, that we're experiencing global cooling rather than global warming. Well, scientists had to take that criticism very seriously, and it turns out that, yes, one satellite was giving anomalous readings. However, that satellite was analyzed very carefully, and it was found that the orbit was drifting. In other words, that satellite was giving incorrect results because it was not calibrated. And another critic of global warming says that this is nothing but cyclic variations of the weather. And there's something to be said there, because there are cyclic variations and anomalies. Take a look at El Nino. That's one of the simplest examples of these cyclic anomalies that come in. And some people say, aha, maybe that explains the strange weather. Well, yes and no. If you take a look at all the major indicators, about 10 of them, if you take a look at the recession of the glaciers, the rise of sea level, the average temperature on the planet Earth, the severity of hurricanes and the severity of droughts, the number of floods, when you add all these indicators together, you realize that it's not anomalous. All the indicators point up in one direction. And so, in other words, yes, there are variations. There are local variations. There's no smoking gun. You cannot say, aha, this proves global warming. No, you can't say that, because it's only an average effect. But on average, if you take a look at the handwriting on the wall, and that's what this new United Nations report does, they look at the decade of 2010, and they say that all the indicators point up. We see glaciers receding, not expanding, temperatures rising, not falling, sea levels rising, not falling, the number of massive storms increasing, the number of droughts and heat waves increasing. All indicators point in the up direction. Now, some people say, well, that's all well and good, but it has nothing to do with me, numero uno. I can lead my life because, well, these are long-term effects on a scale of decades, so it's not going to affect me. Well, yes and no. It is correct to say that these are long-term effects. We're talking about the real effects of global warming not kicking in until mid-century. However, that said, we should also point out that it's affecting the pocketbooks now, not in the future. Take a look at food prices. Food prices will begin to rise as the wacky weather takes its toll on farmers. Not to mention the fact that people are going to have to pay for dikes and sea barriers and seawalls. Mayor Bloomberg, mayor of New York, has already laid out a plan to build such barriers around New York City. And so we're seeing that our lifestyle is beginning to change. We're going to have to pay for insurance for these things. And not only that, but diseases are also going to spread as a consequence. West Nile virus is spread by mosquitoes. However, the eggs of mosquitoes are usually killed off because of the winter snows. Because the winters are getting milder, it means that mosquitoes can migrate north, which means that tropical diseases like malaria, for example, could gradually escape the tropics and enter new terrain because of the fact that the Earth is heating up. And because the seasons are being thrown out of kilter, it means that, well, as I mentioned, agriculture will be affected. Farmers don't know exactly when to plant because of the fact that the summers are getting longer and the winters are getting shorter as a consequence. So it's going to affect our lifestyle as well. And some people say, well, one solution is nuclear energy. Let's go nuclear, say some people. Nuclear does not create carbon dioxide. So some people, even some environmentalists, say, let's give nuclear a second look. Well, take a look at the situation in Germany. The German government said we want a total 100% phase out of nuclear energy. Switzerland said the same thing. Japan is debating it right now, and so is Italy. A total ban on nuclear energy. So Siemens, I attended a talk where the Siemens Corporation presented a very long-term plan for Germany. Germany will continue to be a high-tech leader. It'll continue to be a generator of power. Power using a combination of conservation, solar, wind power, and other such measures. Now, to be fair, right now, solar power and wind power cost more than fossil fuels. That's because of one word, storage. The storage problem, the battery problem, has dogged the field for in fact, 100 years. 100 years ago, Henry Ford and Thomas Edison were friends, and they made a bet as to what would power the future. Henry Ford said gasoline. Thomas Edison said, no, electricity. Well, we all know who won that bet. But some people say now that major corporations like Siemens is investing millions of dollars to perfect this technology, we will reduce the cost. We will reduce the cost of solar and bring down the cost of wind, bring down the cost of hydrogen power, and initiate a hydrogen era, an era that uses hydrogen from the sun as well as hydrogen fuel cells on the planet Earth to create an energy mix. We'll probably always have some coal, some oil, and a mix of renewable technologies to pick up the slack. Otherwise, we could face the fact that many of our cities could go underwater. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Lori Buongiorno. She's a journalist at Business Week for the past 6 years before becoming a freelance writer for The Green Guide, an environmental health newsletter. And she's the author of a new book called Green, Greener, and Greenest, a practical guide to making eco-smart choices as a part of your life. You know, on Exploration, we've had a number of experts talking about the global impact of global warming, talking about the rise of sea levels, talking about energy consumption, oil, energy policy. We've tackled the issue from a number of directions, but Lori Buongiorno takes it to a very, very personal and practical level. What can you do in your lifestyle? What can you do in things that you do every single day of the year to help preserve the environment? Well, that's where the next book comes in, Green, Greener, and Greenest, when we break it down as to what you can do in your lifestyle to save the Earth. The first question for you, Lori, is how did you first get interested in environmental issues and science?
Well, I was a business reporter for many years and got interested in health reporting after my husband died after a 2-year battle with melanoma. I also had 2 young children, one of whom had severe and extensive food allergies. So I started to become interested in health, and I felt like preventing major problems was the best way to go. And so I decided to write about health and started writing about health. And subsequently, a friend asked me to write for her environmental health newsletter. And I wasn't interested at first because I didn't really consider myself an environmentalist. But when she explained the connection between health and the environment, I decided to give it a try. And then I got really interested in the connection between personal health and the health of the planet.
Okay. And why write the book, Green, Greener, and Greenest?
I wrote the book because I believe that most people want to make positive changes that benefit the environment, but I found that a lot of people were confused or overwhelmed or didn't know where to start. So I wanted to write the book so that I could show people the whole spectrum of green options out there, because there isn't just one right way to be green. And anything you can do, small or large, is worthwhile. I basically wanted to make it less overwhelming for people.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into some of the topics, because one thing good about your book is that it's very specific and very much related to people's lifestyles. Okay, food and beverages. How do we go from green, greener to greenest? First of all, what is the difference between green, greener, and greenest, and how does that apply to food and beverages?
Okay, well, the difference between green, greener, and greenest is green tips are easy and inexpensive. Greener tips are for those who want to spend or who have the interest, the time, or the budget to go a little bit deeper into an issue. And greenest suggestions are for those who are able to fully take on an issue. And lots of times those greenest suggestions are for someone who, you know, involve getting more active in a broader way.
And I guess the greenest category would also call for political action as
well,
right?
Exactly. In many cases, it's for broader community action or political action.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into the contents of your book. First of all, what we eat and what we drink. How does this stack up to green, greener, and greenest?
Well, I mean, there's so many different categories of food, but we can do produce because that's something that a lot of people care about. So one thing that people can do if they're worried about, a green thing that you can do if you're worried about pesticide residues, is eat a wide variety of produce to get all the nutrients you need and to protect yourself from exposure to the same pesticides. A greener thing that you can do is to buy organic versions of the most contaminated produce, and some of the Environmental Working Group has a list of the top 12 most contaminated fruits and vegetables and the least contaminated. And some of the most contaminated are things like peaches and apples and strawberries. And some of the least contaminated are things like spinach, pears, and cucumbers. And then greenest. And another thing that you can do that's greener is to buy local whenever possible. Going to your local farmer's market cuts down on fuel to ship food across the country, and you're getting tastier and healthier, in some cases, food than you do at the supermarket. Greenest is to, grow your own produce or join a community-supported agriculture program where you can, at the beginning of a growing season, buy a share of a local farmer's harvest, pick it up each week.
Okay, and let's be specific. You have a section on fish and seafoods. Everyone wants to get omega-3 fatty acids for their health benefits, but also seafood contains mercury left over from the burning of coal. Coal-fired plants produce an enormous amount of mercury, which then lands back in the oceans as acid rain, which then gets into salmon and whatever, and then gets into your body. So what are your thoughts about fish and seafood?
Well, one of the easiest things you can do is to get a fish list or a fish card and bring it with you next time you go to the fish store or you go to the supermarket. But some tips that I have in here are, in Green, Greener, Greenest is green. When eating canned tuna, buy Chunk Light, not albacore tuna, which has three times the amounts of mercury as light tuna. So that's one way to do something that's fairly easy. A greener thing that you can do is choose wild and canned Alaskan salmon over farm-raised salmon. Farm-raised salmon tends to be fattier, and some of their feed, which is where a lot of these toxins like PCBs concentrate, and also the feed is sometimes contaminated with some of those chemicals. A greenest thing that you can do is, this is a place to try and get active. Urge your elected officials to support legislation that's aimed at reducing mercury in the environment so that we can eat all kinds of fish and not have to worry about it.
Okay, and moving on to meat and dairy products. Of course, we're all concerned about animal fat, which tends to clog up our bodies and our arteries. But we also have to worry about antibiotics, and we have to also worry about other things in meat and dairy. Any thoughts?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that you can do that's really easy, and this is a green suggestion in the book, is minimize exposure to fat. This is where many, for obvious reasons, but also because it contains, that's where a lot of the toxic chemicals such as dioxins concentrate. So if you either buy low-fat dairy products or you buy low-fat meat or cut off the fat from the meat when you're cooking it, these are ways that you could cut down on fat and it's healthier. Greener things in terms of meat would be, to buy organic when possible. It's your best bet that animals weren't raised with antibiotics or added hormones or, many other harmful practices. With dairy and meat and red meat, grass-fed is another thing to look for. It's leaner, so you have to cook it differently, but cows were not meant to be raised on grain. They were meant to be raised on grass, and grass-fed cows' meat and milk is actually healthier for you. It has some beneficial fats that are actually good for you. A greenest thing would be to eliminate meat eliminate meat entirely from your diet. That's the greenest thing. A green thing would be to eat less meat.
Okay.
So you don't have to go straight to that.
Now, we have this perpetual problem that even though things that are labeled organic may not be organic. I mean, what does it mean if it says organic? Maybe it's a scam. Any thoughts about what it means when a product says organic? I mean, how can you be sure?
Well, it really depends on the product. In food, if it has the USDA certified organic stamp of approval on it, it means that the fruits or vegetables it means that there were very strict standards that were met and that a third party verified it. So if you see an organic label with the USDA seal of approval, you can be pretty sure that you're getting an organic product when it comes to food.
And what about the perpetual problem of plastic versus paper wrappers in bags?
That is an age-old question. It really depends. I mean, basically, the answer is to use cloth whenever possible. But if that's not possible, then if you're near a body of water and you can get recycled paper bags, you should choose that. If you are not near a body of water, because you don't want the plastic bags to end up in the ocean and harm wildlife, if you are not near a body of water or the bags are not made from recycled paper, post-consumer recycled paper, then you're better off choosing plastic. But you should also think about what you're actually doing with these bags when you're done with them. I mean, paper can be recycled. Plastic, I use plastic bags. I reuse them as garbage liners so I don't have to buy garbage liners. So think about what you do with it when you're done with them as well.
And can you be sure that the plastic is biodegradable?
No. I mean, you could be pretty sure that it's not biodegradable and it's going to be in a landfill for a long time. So you don't, that's why you want to try and recycle. I mean, in New York City, you're going to be able to bring plastic bags to stores and get them recycled, or you can reuse them.
Okay. Well, now moving on to the home. Personal care products, babies and children. One problem is diapers. Some people complain that, first of all, diapers are extremely filthy and contain tremendous amount of germs, and we generate enormous quantities of Pampers for anyone who's ever changed a diaper before. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think a big question that people think about in terms of diapers is whether or not to use reusable or disposable. And one of the things I found in doing this research is that it doesn't really make a huge difference one way or the other. They both take up resources. They both have pros and cons. And the conclusion I came to is that, people should actually think about using diapers and think about, their needs and their lifestyles and do what's best for them. But to also, if you live in a place where landfill is an issue, then maybe, and you can use reusable, great. But if you're in a place where water quality is an issue, then using disposable is actually better.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest is Lori Bongiorno, formerly of Business Week magazine and now an environmentalist who has just written a book called Green, Greener, and Greenest. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And be sure to check out my website. It's www.mkaku.org. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a dialogue with Lori Bongiorno, a journalist at Business Week and author of a new book called Green, Greener, and Greenest, a practical guide to making eco-smart choices as a part of your life. And we're going to continue the discussion how, on a personal level, you can begin the process of saving the earth. Well, let's now continue with our interview with Lori Buongiorno, author of Green, Greener, and Greenest. Well, Lori, where we last left off, we were talking about diapers. What's the best way to dispose diapers and still maintain a green environment?
Something like diapers. I mean, they're a necessity, although there is one of the greenest suggestions in the book is that there is this new thing called the elimination communication method that is for, you know, gaining some momentum in the United States. And the basic gist is that there are certain signals that a baby makes in advance of having to go, and so parents can actually start potty training a baby pretty early on. I mean, that seems to me not something that many people can do, but that's pretty much the only way to really cut down on diaper use.
Okay, and speaking about home care products, the average person goes through an enormous amount of chemicals. You mentioned, for example, in your book, hair dye, nail polish, deodorants, and antiperspirants, sun protection. We go through an enormous amount of chemicals that go right down the drain. What are your thoughts about minimizing our imprint on the environment?
Yes, and on our personal health. I mean, most people use about 9 different personal care products a day, encountering a combined average of 126 different ingredients. One of the easiest things that you can do is to protect your own health and the health of the planet is to use fewer products. That's a green suggestion in the book. That's one thing you can do. I mean, other things that you can do are trying to stay away from the most harmful chemicals.
Like?
One thing that I guess is pretty hard to find, petroleum byproducts. There is a chemical called 1,4-dioxane that has been getting a lot of attention lately because it can be contaminated with carcinogenic impurities. The problem is that it's really hard to know from reading the labels what it's in. And so one thing that I tell people to do is go to the Environmental Working Group's cosmetics database, which is www.cosmeticsdatabase.com. And you could just type in the name of a product or type in the name of a chemical. It's really very user-friendly, and it can help you learn a lot about what you're using on your body. A greenest thing that people could do is, you know, either buy from companies that are starting to make changes. And some of those companies are Aubrey Organics, Jason Natural Products, Burt's Bees, or try to get more active politically.
Okay. And speaking about beverages, a lot of people drink bottled water. First of all, is there any advantage at all to drinking bottled water? And second of all, there are a lot of products that guarantee filtering of water, but are they just bunk or can they really filter water?
Okay. Well, first things first, there is no proof that bottled water is any better than tap water. In fact, if you, the NRDC did a study that showed that 25% of bottled water is just tap water, and it's, sometimes it's further treated and sometimes it's not. I mean, experts agree that drinking tap water is the way to go for many reasons. Also, it's very expensive for a lot of people.
Sure.
Now, in terms of water filters, I mean, the best way to know, I mean, first of all water filter, the best way to figure out which water filter you need is to find out what's in your water. And everyone gets a drinking water report called the Drinking Water Quality Report in July, around July, first of every year. And that can tell you what's in your water, or you can get your water tested. But once you know what's in your water, then you know what you have to get rid of. And there are 3 different kinds of filters: carbon filters, distillers, and reverse osmosis. And they each get rid of different things. The one thing you want to look for in all filters is to make sure it's NSF certified, which is an independent nonprofit that certifies food products and water-related products. So just make sure it's NSF certified and make sure you change the filter according to manufacturer's directions.
Okay, let me ask you a question that is not addressed in this book, but people have asked me. And that is, if you analyze your blood for chemicals like lead and mercury, of course, you can go to a scientific laboratory and find out exactly what kind of junk is inside your blood. But that's not for the average person. How would an average person be able to find out how much lead, mercury, and different kind of pollutants are in their body by analyzing the blood? And can you remove them? Any thoughts?
Wow, that's a good question. Lead, I mean, most kids under the age of six get lead tests at the doctor's office pretty regularly. And I think, you know, that's fairly easily measured in the blood, and people have access to that. Mercury, the same thing. I mean, people, you can go to your doctor and ask for a blood test. You can also go to the Sierra Club, and Greenpeace right now have a kit that they're selling for, I think it's $25, and you can sniff a piece of your hair off and send it to their lab, and they'll tell you how much mercury you have in your body. It depends on what the chemical is in terms of what you can do about it. In the book, I say continually, like, prevention is your best bet. A chemical like bisphenol A, which is getting a lot of attention these days because of plastic baby bottles, it has estrogenic properties, and it can leach out of some plastic baby bottles and bottles in general. That doesn't stay in your body for a long time, but we're continually exposed to it. Other things stay in your body for a really long time. There's really nothing you can do once it gets there. So, you know, it just depends on, you know, what your priorities are and what you're trying to accomplish. But, I mean, I think the first step, if you really want to know what's going on, is going to your doctor and talking to your doctor.
And any thoughts about chelating? Some people have used that to eliminate certain, let's say, metals in their body. We use it in a chemistry laboratory all the time. But what about how safe it is for humans? Any thoughts?
I haven't really looked into that.
Right. Okay, moving on. Home building and improvement. Of course, in metropolitan areas, very few people build their own house from ground up. However, all of us have to worry about formaldehyde in the walls, mold, and stuff like that. So let's talk about home building. First of all, formaldehyde and other chemicals that build up in the walls. Some people say that if you make a house environmentally friendly so that you seal off the house to conserve heat, you build up formaldehyde as a consequence, and that's not good for you. But what are your thoughts?
Well, that is very true. If all these newer constructions should have a really great ventilation system so that you're getting clean air into your home or apartment continually. So ventilation plays a huge part. And preventing some of these chemicals from getting into your house in the first place is another great thing to do. There are more and more, you know, formaldehyde-free products and low VOC products on the market. And there are a lot of great stores that you can go to learn more about them. And great resources that I can tell you about right now. I would say, Building Green, for consumers, buildinggreen.com is a good resource, although some of the better parts of the site are pretty expensive. But the Green Building Resource Center, that's Global Greens, www.globalgreen.org, has a lot of information for consumers. The U.S. Green Building Council, which many people will have heard of in terms of LEED, LEED houses or LEED buildings. There's a lot of that in the news. They now have a consumer page website called greenhomeguide.org, which has a lot of resources. But these days, you know, you can just go to an environmental. You can even go to Home Depot, which has a whole assortment of green products, and ask for low off-gassing products like low VOC paints, which are available from many of the major paint suppliers, and even buy wood that doesn't off-gas. You just have to ask questions like that.
Okay, now let's do the big one, and that is energy and carbon. Everyone's worried about that, and people would like to contribute to an environmental movement to reduce our carbon footprint, as we sometimes say. But as you mentioned in your book, the average U.S. household emits 22,000 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. So it seems as if each house is a a gigantic wellspring of greenhouse gases. So what do we do about it?
Well, you know, try to use less energy is like, and when you do replace appliances and other things in your apartment or house, make them as energy efficient as possible. In Green, Greener, Greenest, I talk about some of the easy things that you can do to make a big difference. Installing an energy store thermostat will save you 500 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. Switching to low-flow showerheads doesn't just save you water, it also saves your energy, about 700 pounds a year. If you were to use 5 compact fluorescent light bulbs in your house, 300 pounds of carbon dioxide a year would be saved from being emitted into the atmosphere. Sealing up leaks around doors, those are all things that people can do. Those are 4 things that people can do that are relatively easy, relatively inexpensive, and will make a pretty big difference.
And let's talk about those light bulbs. How good are the new light bulbs compared to the old light bulbs?
Well, it depends. I mean, it just depends on, what your priorities are. And I mean, I have a few of them, and they're fine. And I don't put them all over my house. I've picked a few different places where they're, I use them in my closets. I use them in some hallways. And as incandescents go out, I am, thinking about how to replace them. But, they are getting better. One thing that consumers, an Environmental Defense has a great light bulb guide that you can go to on their website, which I don't know offhand. The other thing for consumers to know is buy one that's Energy Star certified, because that's a guarantee that the bulb will last for a certain amount of time, that the quality of light will be good, and that when you turn it on, it will come on immediately and there won't be that lag. People worry about, one of the questions I always get is how to dispose of them. That's tricky. Household hazardous waste is how you're supposed to dispose of them with HHW. But one of the things that you can do is go on to earth911.org and see if there's a drop-off center near you. If you can't find one near you, you should seal them in 2 different Ziploc bags before you throw them out. But I think that it's going to get easier for consumers to dispose of CFLs. I think we're going to start to see some in-store disposal options. I mean, the other day I was in Whole Foods and I saw, they're taking batteries now. I think it's just a matter of time before people can start dropping off their old light bulbs as well.
Okay, well, again, you mentioned that the average U.S. household emits 22,000 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. You mentioned how we can reduce it rather easily by maybe 2,000, 3,000, but we're still up to 20,000 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. Let me ask the big question. What would it take to go solar in a house and remove yourself from the electric grid totally?
Well, I'm not an expert on solar, but what I think it's sort of out of the reach for many people. There's all kinds of new technologies being worked on, which is said to make the price will be coming down. The other thing you can do that without slapping solar panels on your house is you can, and a lot of people in cities don't really have control over that anyway, is you can switch to a green pricing program and you can buy renewable energies through your utility or through an alternative utility. And that's like a little bit more money each month, probably. I mean, it depends on where you live. But, that's a way to support renewables without having to break the bank. And the one thing you should do there is go to Green E. It's a green power certification program. And that will tell you which programs are good and which are not so good. It's www.green-e.org. So, I mean, that's within the realm of, that's much more reachable for most consumers than slapping solar panels on their house.
And I understand that you want to say something more about solar.
Well, I wanted to just say that that solar water heating is an option that's becoming more accessible, depending upon where you live. It's a little more expensive, but it's a way to get involved in solar that is easier for most people right now.
Okay, moving on. Apparel and furnishings and cleaning. First of all, people do go to the dry cleaners, which use quite a bit of toxic chemicals to clean your clothes. But any thoughts in this direction?
Well, in terms of dry cleaning, yes, Perk is the thing that you want to avoid, and 80% of dry cleaners use Perk. That's the solvent. There are different things that you can do. One is if you do have to dry clean your clothing, and you don't have an alternative to Perk, what you can do is you could just air out your clothes before you put them in your closet, or if you're driving home, take them out of the plastic and leave your windows open. There are also some alternatives to traditional dry cleaning, and two of them are considered environmentally preferable by the EPA. One is called carbon dioxide cleaning, and the other is called wet cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
Wet cleaning uses water and non-toxic soap to clean clothes, but it's maybe not best for all types of clothes. What I hear is that you want to use them on items that you would consider hand washing at home, such as silks or linen. And you can just ask your dry cleaner if they do wet cleaning and maybe test an item or two. In terms of carbon dioxide cleaning, if you want to find a cleaner that does that, look and see if there's a Hanger's cleaners near you, or visit www.findco2.com. And then, a greenest thing to do is to buy fewer clothes that require dry cleaning, or to hand wash as many items as possible.
And you also have a little section on jewelry, which you can say is a, quote, girl's best friend, unquote. However, as you also point out, blood diamonds are in the news, and jewelry is the currency for civil war and mass slaughter and genocide in Africa. So any thoughts about jewelry?
I mean, one thing that you can do is you can buy estate jewelry, vintage jewelry. I mean, that's a way to still wear things that you like and not have to participate in that.
Okay, moving on now. Pest control. Well, if you live in Manhattan, one thing you have to live with is roaches. However, poisons are not exactly the safest thing to spray all over your house. And when you, quote, bomb, unquote, an apartment, you're injecting enormous quantities of insecticide into your house. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and those pesticides can stay there for a long time. I'd say that in this case, as well as in many cases, prevention is your best defense. So plugging up holes and all of that kind of stuff, and doing anything, and cleaning up and making sure that there's no water or crumbs for roaches or any other pest to feed on is your best bet. That said, they still sometimes find their ways to get in. And then I would say that what you should do is just look for the least toxic ways that that you can find to get rid of them. I mean, in the case of roaches, just spraying all over, A, isn't even working anymore because roaches are starting to become immune to the pesticides that we're using. But also, then you can, your children are crawling on the floors and the actual residues are on your countertops. So how about using stuff in, gels and cracks and crevices so that you're not really being exposed to them on a regular basis? I mean, those are the kinds of suggestions that I have in Green, Green, Arena.
Okay, another big one, transportation. We all have to get to work, we have to get to school, we have to get to different places, but of course, to move an object requires electricity, requires gasoline, which in turn, all of which generate carbon dioxide. So what are your thoughts about a big one, transportation?
Well, luckily, living in New York City, I get to walk or take public transportation when possible, and I'm really lucky about that, but I know most people aren't that lucky. Okay, well, what you can do is for your car, you don't have to go out to buy a hybrid to make a difference. That's my number one message here. And if you are going to go out and buy a hybrid, I would say that you really need to do your homework, because all hybrids are not created equally. Some manufacturers use the technology to make cars that are more powerful and don't make them as energy efficient as possible. So when you're buying a hybrid or any car, make sure that you're buying the most fuel-efficient model in the category that you need. So if you need a minivan, look for the one that's going to get the most miles to the gallon, period. And if you're looking at a hybrid and it's not getting that many more miles per gallon than its conventional counterpart, then you're not doing anything to help the environment. But if you're not going to buy a new car, and many of us can't, there are things that you can do, like driving the speed limit. Driving 65 miles an hour is actually going to driving 65 miles per hour instead of 55 miles per hour increases fuel consumption by 20%. Driving at 75 miles per hour rather than 65 miles per hour increases consumption by another 25%. So you can really save a lot by just not speeding, rolling up your windows when you're on the highway, bundling errands together, don't idle your engine, take good care of your car and get regular tune-ups to maximize energy efficiency, keeping your tires inflated. There's a whole long list of things that you can do, green, greener, and greenest options. The absolute greenest thing that you can do is to find ways to drive less.
Okay. And what about biofuels? What about biofuels and the recent interest in ethanol and using corn products? Any thoughts?
I mean, biofuels are really complicated. Not all biofuels are made the same. There's a lot of controversy over them right now. They're also competing, food prices are being driven up by biofuels. They are only part of the solution. What we really want is not biofuels made from corn. We want biofuels made from switchgrass and other wastes, which are more efficient. But really what we need is we need cars that can go a lot further on a gallon of fuel than we have right now. And unfortunately, the only way we're going to have that is if car manufacturers and the government step in.
Any thoughts about the fact that Detroit has been the number one bottleneck, the number one obstacle preventing higher fuel standards on the roads?
I don't get it. I don't get it. They have the technology. I don't understand why.
I mean, foreign cars are much more efficient than American cars, so it's not a question of the laws of physics, right?
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, it would be a great way for Detroit to revitalize itself.
And any thoughts about the electric car, the hydrogen car, and new cars that are even beyond hybrid cars?
Well, we're not seeing them yet. Experts are saying they'll be here sooner than we expect. Really, we just want to find the cars that go the furthest on a gallon of fuel, or that go the furthest for the least amount of fuel input. And hopefully, we will all be seeing a lot more affordable options in the near future.
Okay. And also, to sort of like wrap things up, what are some of the organizations that have websites that also talk about legislation, about political action, about their political agendas? Which organizations have you worked with? What are the websites? And which ones would you recommend?
Okay. Well, I would say the Natural Resources Defense Council. Frances Beinecke wrote the foreword to Green, Greener, Greenest, and they are an organization that that are involved in many different areas of the environment, and they have lots of take action. So if you're interested in getting more politically active, you could sign up for their email alerts, and you can weigh in on the things that you care about. And the website is www.nrdc.org. The Union of Concerned Scientists has cover a lot of issues. There's a lot of food issues as well, but transportation, they have a great website for hybrids. And I don't know offhand the URL, but I'm just looking it up. Here, give me one second.
Well, people can Google the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Fine. And then the Sierra Club is another organization that does, broad number of issues. And the last one, I think there's so many. And actually, Green, Greener, Greenest has so many ways for people to get active in more broad ways. And there are, a lot of organizations.
And that concludes the interview with our special guest today. She was Lori Buongiorno of Businessweek magazine, now with Green Guide. And she's the author of a new book called Green, Greener, Greenest, How You Can Get Activated to Save the Planet. However, in the remaining minute of exploration, let me make a short comment. And that is, just because President Obama will be president of the United States in January, it doesn't mean that we can simply fall asleep and let him do all the heavy lifting. It actually means that we have to put pressure on him because there's going to be pressure on him in the other direction. In other words, now that he will become president of the United States, all sorts of different large corporations and special interests are going to be lobbying him to go the other way and forget many of his campaign pledges. I mean, after all, he is a politician, and the only way to keep politicians really honest is to put pressure on them to make sure that they carry out their campaign promises. This means that to be green is more than simply having a green lifestyle. It's more than simply picking up after yourself. It means getting, in some sense, politically active. It means getting active at your local level or regional level or maybe even national or international level because, quite frankly, time is running out. Now, we have a little bit of a breather in the sense that because of the collapse of the economic structure, it does mean that, people are consuming less, and as a consequence, oil prices have plummeted like a rock. However, that's not a cure. Eventually, oil prices will begin to rise again because the economy will be back up on its feet, perhaps in a year, 2 years, who knows when. But when it is back up to speed, people are going to be consuming fossil fuels just as rapidly as they were before. How do I know that? Because that's what happened during the first energy crisis back in the 1970s. Right after the oil crisis hit back then, people were all saying, let's all turn green, let's all conserve gas. And right after that, they became gas guzzlers. So the only way to make sure that we keep a totally green planet is to put pressure. To put pressure on the politicians, to educate our fellow taxpayers so that they can be energized, and to basically spread the word around. So in other words, it's very good that we have a green lifestyle, but it's not enough, especially because of the fact that we could be hitting a point of no return. We've already passed one point of no return, and that is no matter what we do at the present time, it looks as if the northern polar ice sheet will in fact be gone. This means that our children and grandchildren will grow up with a globe that looks different from the globe that we grow up with as baby boomers. In other words, there's not going to be a North Pole. So in other words, we have already crossed one point of no return. And how many more points of no return do we have to cross before we finally cross the big one? And that, I hope, never comes to pass, because that point of no return could be life-threatening. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Lori Buongiorno, formerly of Businessweek magazine, now with The Green Guide and author of the new book, Green, Greener, and Greenest. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, urging you to listen to Exploration every week when we discuss science and its impact on society. Good day.